Your spiritual fulfillment in these years may come from an honest, full reading of Scripture, an earnest, full exercise of reason, and an ample, full appreciation of tradition. Consider the verse, "Whoever does not renounce all that he has cannot be my student." You may have occasion to take a quiet walk this week on the Esplanade, down through the public garden, along the Emerald Necklace, out on the beach. You promised last week to make a monthly ocean visit, did you not? As you walk, wander, wonder, as you saunter with a saintly step along, say, the Commonwealth Mall, ponder our scripture today. Luke's collections of sayings here, Luke 14:25, in the middle of 10 chapters or so, Luke 9-19, that are Luke's own developed composition, including many of the most memorable teachings of primitive Christianity, the Good Samaritan, the lost coin, the lost sheep, the prodigal son, and others, are, in all honesty, somewhat inelegantly jumbled together, including our passage here, in ways that do not necessarily easily fully harmonize. Following Augustine's advice that a sermon in form should resemble the form of the scripture on which it is based, you here are offered in this sermon a collection of teachings that, in all honesty, are somewhat inelegantly jumbled together in ways that do not fully harmonize. Luke 14:25 is composed near the end of the first century, the dating of Luke being somewhere between the writing of Mark in 70 AD and Luke's first citation and other sources in the second century. That is, the passage carries a hyperbolic dominical saying, not unlike the hyperbole in "If thine eye offend thee, pluck it out," setting distance, a disciplined existential distance, between self and parents, self and spouse, self and progeny, self and family, self and security. That is, following in faith, being a disciple, a student, will include sometimes loss and conflict. Striking, isn't it, how this prediction of leaving kith and kin, leaving home, intersects with the experience of coming to college. Our text is perhaps best understood in Matthew's rendering. Matthew and Luke both have received the sayings from a shared earlier document known by scholars as Q. Matthew writes, "Whoever loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me." The use of the image of the cross here probably means it was originally composed in the preaching of the church, not in the teaching of the Lord, whose cross was not yet, after all, at this point in the gospel narrative on the horizon. There is not a direct line, if there is any line at all, from Luke 14 in 90 AD or so to Jesus' teaching in 30 AD. Luke is addressed to men. That is, notice the absence, as Sharon Ringey reminds us, of husbands in the list of those mentioned. A further indication that Luke, largely inclusive, by the way, in his gospel of women, is using a document he has inherited, Q. The reading does not reject the significance of everyday economic, social, familial, political, even military life. The many parables of tower and king keep our feet on the ground. That is, there is a real respect here for what we might call simply common sense. Prudent action is the essential theme. Luke 14 asks in a serendipitously timely and direct way for us, considering Syria, that we count the cost of a project, a plan, a conflict, the cost of going to war. Strictly speaking, the collection of sayings and many parables, again, written by Luke, some coming to us from the collection we call Q, then perhaps shaped by Luke, do not come to a neat conclusion in verse 33, the need to renounce all possessions. But the general point is clear enough. Discipleship costs. Nor in some is this a call to asceticism, but more a simple readiness for God's daily demand. Consider a second verse of Scripture. What king going to encounter another king in war will not sit down first and take counsel whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? On this hypothetical walk this week, you might be thinking for a moment about Syria. You might be quietly thankful to live in a great country like ours, wherein the uses of power with responsibility are considered and discussed, where a president turns to a Congress for deliberation, debate, and vote, where women and men in military service serve others by serving the cause of peace and the keeping of the peace. If I were along with you, I might chime in with a heartfelt gratitude for the freedom of the pulpit, for the freedom of this pulpit over many decades. Our community has graciously, over time, listened to what it did not always like and protected the statement of what it did not always affirm. That, on your part, is truly gracious. We should bluntly repeat that on these things, grave issues of war and peace, people of good heart and mind, good will and spirit can honestly differ and disagree, and often do. You might also be thinking about religious teaching about war and peace. I notice by Google, by the way, that there is exactly one book of sermons in print addressing the war in Iraq, 2001-2007, just one. I happen to know the ISBN number by heart and can spell the middle name of the author. From several rehearsals here, others with you on this walk might remember that our tradition, the Christian tradition, has two sorts of teachings, pacifism and activism. On the left hand, we have the earliest teaching, Matthew 5 and elsewhere, not to resist the evil one, a pacifist tradition with far more support than just the Mennonites, Quakers, Amish, and others. In fact, this chapel and its monument to King outside and our school of theology, including my namesake, A-L-L-A-N, Alan Knight Chalmers, embraced pacifism over many years ago. If anyone smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. But our debate across the country today is more on the other hand, the right hand, if you will, Romans 13 and elsewhere, of just war theory. Here is the recognition, speaking of wisdom and innocence, serpents and doves, that justice for the lamb sometimes means resistance to the wolf. It will be easy, finger by finger, for you to remember walking the issues and questions in this second form of Christian teaching. You know them. Is the action responsive, not preemptive? Multilateral, not unilateral? Ameliorative, not imperial? Foresighted, not unforeseeable? Proportionately limited, not potentially limitless? In the particular case of Syria 2013, grateful for presidential leadership that is war wary, if not war weary, and willing to engage discussion, other questions may touch you as now studying as you are in a great university, you exercise your reason. What is the exact desired outcome? What the possible unintended consequences? Why 90 days for a 1 to 2 day missile shot across the bow? Who quietly or silently and for what reasons is propelling this? For an enforcement of an international norm to be real, must it be military or are there credible other options? Just what would a limited, proportional, meaningful deterrent be? Have we exhausted every serious form of serious diplomacy? What sorts of precedents are we setting? Alternatively, another set of questions. What are the costs to peace and order of inaction in the face of 1,400 gassed to death? Does not such a brazen breach of an important norm require response if such a norm is not completely to unravel? Is the country war-weary or war-wary or both? Can we say and do more for refugees, some 2 million today from Syria, than we have done? Is what is popular necessarily what is right? How are we truly and best to deliberate carefully, choose wisely, and embrace responsibility? What are we going to do about this? For now, we, in the shadow of Luke 14 here, will raise these questions and watch and listen as the debate ensues this week. We shall affirm, though, listening to Luke 14, that the skeptical voices need carefully to be heard, both from within the church and from within the culture. Consider a third verse of Scripture. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my student, my disciple. Your walk may bring you back past Marsh Chapel. Think, if you do, about our time here 2 days ago on Friday afternoon. It was a beautiful, sun-dappled, bright Friday on Marsh Plaza. Thanks to the College of Arts and Sciences, ice cream was served from 4 formal stations. Hundreds came to partake. The chapel organ was booming as musicians prepared for a busy weekend. The Charles River glistened beyond the beach. Blue sky, cool air, communal gathering, and ice cream, a happy hour or two, September 6th. I watched as terriers, older and younger, sampled the ice cuisine. Some looked into the chapel, named for a Methodist minister, our fourth president, Daniel Marsh, as is the plaza itself. Some squinted up at John Wesley above the front chapel door, there in a robe, reading his Bible, the founder of Methodism, an English Protestant movement in the 1700s. A couple finished their cones, looked in at the conic stained glass windows, glanced at the Methodist hymnals in the pews, looked up at Abraham Lincoln, not a Methodist himself, though his biography, personal faithfulness, social responsibility, epitomized the best of Methodism in his 19th century. 3 young men ringed the Boston University seal next to the Martin Luther King Jr. monument, and avoiding stepping on the seal, read its motto, crafted long ago by Daniel Marsh, a thoroughly Methodist triad: learning, virtue, piety. And I wondered, how could I briefly say to these hundreds just what lasting meaning the Methodist provenance of Boston University continues to have? What difference does it make that the university was founded in 1839 by John Dempster, a Methodist minister from upstate New York, who founded the theological seminary that later became our school? After all, BU today is a large, urban, non-sectarian, northern, private research university which includes women and men from the whole inhabited earth. What lingers out of our birth in Methodism? Learning lingers. The seal tells the story. From its inception in America, Methodism, more energetically than any other tradition, established schools and colleges from Beacon Hill, Boston, all the way to Route 66 and Claremont in California. Today, 128 universities, seminaries, and other schools beautify America, all fruit of an early love of learning exemplified by John Wesley himself. He, an Oxford don, a classics scholar, a biblical theologian. Speaking of his beloved Bible, said Wesley, "I desire to be homo unius libri, a man of one book." But Methodism never invested all authority in the Bible, because learning about the Bible pointed Wesley and his followers to other truths in reason and tradition. Learning was the key. Again, my namesake, Alan Knight Chalmers, a mentor to King and others, implored his graduate students to read a book a day. That old saying, nihil humanum, nothing human is foreign to us, expresses the love of learning inherited from our Methodist past. Virtue lingers. But Methodism has more than academic rigor to offer us. We academics sometimes think if we write it down, we don't have to live it through. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Learning and virtue and piety, knowing and doing and being, if you will, are all part of becoming fully human. Methodism emphasized and emphasizes still the shared experiences in life that help to make and keep us human, that which has been believed always and everywhere by everyone. In essentials, unity, non-essentials, liberty, and in all things, charity. We are a people happy in God. And his last words, the best of all is, God is with us. Our BU history comes out of a movement of doers in the main. Dreamers, yes, doubters too, but largely doers. They put a church in virtually every county in the country. They split North and South ahead of the Civil War over slavery. Having been poor, they ministered always and fully with the poor. They tithed, as most still do, giving away 10% of each year's earnings. Wesley put it in his own phrase, do all the good you can, for faith without works is dead. Our modern Boston University work with the Chelsea schools can stand as an example of a dozen other great BU transformative gifts which well up out of the ancient Methodist bone structure of this school. BU over 170 years has defined itself not by whom it excluded, but by whom it included, the children of the poor, the working poor, the working class, former slaves, people of color, different religious traditions when it was hard to do so, women, and in our time, the otherwise able, the gay and lesbian community, internationals, and others. Piety lingers. I admit this is a superannuated word. It sounds vaguely, curiously cloistered. But what it means is vital, crucial for you and me. That is, what we learn and how we act finally shape who we are. There is a lasting, soulful dimension to the human being, an ownmost self behind the public persona, a multidimensional person in the tradition of Boston University's own philosophical tradition of personalism. Down deeper than the one-dimensional surface. At heart, for the Methodists, piety meant love. To love one another, even as God has loved us. Friends, if we are not both lovers and knowers, learners and lovers, we have left behind a huge part of our souls. But if we do love one another, these Methodists remind us, God abides in us and is made whole in us. There are many ways of keeping faith. The tolerant, magnanimous openness of Methodism at its best reminds us so. If thine heart be as mine, give me thy hand, said John Wesley. That is, under the seal on Marsh Plaza, on a sunlit, gleaming day, there lies the wonder and the promise of love. After all, without love, without an experience of love, what is life for? Are we lovers anymore? Charles Wesley, John's 18th century musical brother, sang it this way in a hymn written for the opening of an elementary school in 1762. Unite the pair so long disjoined, knowledge and vital piety. I have to think that these long dead forebears would smile with delight at the next generation coming alive, knowing, doing, being, in a happy gathering in early September on Marsh Plaza, September 6th, Boston University. Beloved, hear the gospel, Luke 14:25. Your spiritual fulfillment in college may include a leisurely walk or two, meditating on scripture, considering the current quandary of Syria, stopping in the sunshine of Marsh Plaza to think about our inheritance. That is, your spiritual fulfillment in these years may come from an honest, full reading of scripture, an earnest, full exercise of reason, an ample, full appreciation of tradition.